driving home for lunch. Marietta cooked something delicious each Wednesday, and he and Aunt Flory ate on her back porch with the birds cawing in the distance. Beyond her aviary, the acres were laden with cotton, and the picking would start as soon as the weather cooled. They had the same conversations about Stella and Liza and law school, but they did not dwell on the lawsuits and legal troubles. Losing the land was never discussed. After a long lunch, Joel stopped by his home to check on Nineveh and Amos and make sure nothing had changed. It had not. He usually met with Buford to discuss the cotton, and he eventually made it to town, where he parked on the square and walked into the Wilbanks firm for a few hours of work. John and Russell assigned him briefs to research and write in his spare time at Ole Miss. Late in the day, they would have a quick bourbon on the terrace. Then Joel would load up his files and head back to Oxford. After a couple of attempts, he realized he could not spend the night in his home. The place was too quiet, lonely, and depressing. There were too many photographs of the family in happier times, too many reminders. In his father's study, on the wall next to his desk, there was a large photo of Pete, taken the day he graduated from West Point. Joel had admired it his entire life. Now it was so heartbreaking, he couldn't make himself look at it. He and Stella had discussed removing all of the photos and books and medals and boxing them up for storage, but couldn't muster the energy. Besides, Liza might return one day and attempt to renew her life, and such memories would be important to her. So their fine home sat gloomy, dark, and deserted, with only Nineveh easing through it each day, dusting here and there, and doing as little as possible. With each visit to the farm, Joel found himself eager to leave it. His life there would never be the same. His father was dead. His mother's future was uncertain. Stella was headed for the bright lights up north and a life far removed from Ford County. The Wilbanks brothers were dropping serious hints about Joel joining their firm after graduation, but that would not happen. In Clanton, he would always be Pete Banning's boy, the son of the guy they fried in the electric chair right up there in the main courtroom. Seriously? Did they really expect Joel to practice law in a courtroom where they killed his father? Did they really expect him to live a normal, successful life in a town where half the people viewed his father as a murderer and the other half suspected his mother was fooling around with the preacher? Clanton was the last place he would live. Biloxi, on the other hand, looked promising. He wasn't stalking Marianne Maloof, but he knew her dormitory and her class schedule. Armed with this intelligence, he managed to bump into her a couple of times on campus. She seemed to enjoy the encounters. Occasionally, he watched her from a distance and was irritated at the number of other boys doing the same. When Kentucky rolled into town for a football game on October 1st, Joel asked her for a date. She declined and reminded him that she was engaged. Her fiancé had also attended Ole Miss and still had friends on campus. She couldn't be seen with someone else. She did not say that she didn't want to date someone else, only that she couldn't be seen dating someone else. Joel noted the important distinction. He replied that, at least in his opinion, it wasn't fair for such a beautiful co-ed to have her social life so restricted while her fiancé was off, no doubt, having a grand time in D.C. He asked her why she wasn't wearing an engagement ring. She didn't have one. He persisted, and she finally agreed to a late dinner. Not a date, just a meal. He met her outside the Lyceum after dark, and they drove downtown to the square, parked in front of Nielsen's department store, and walked a block along South Lamar to the mansion, the only restaurant open late. As they entered, Joel saw William Faulkner at his customary table, alone, eating and reading a magazine. He had just published Intruder in the Dust, his 14th novel. A critic writing for the Memphis Press-Simeter gave it a mixed review. But more important, another story in the same newspaper revealed that Faulkner had sold the film rights to MGM. Joel bought the book at a small store in Jackson when he was visiting his mother. At that time, there was no bookstore in Oxford, and the locals cared little about what their most famous son happened to be writing and publishing. As a general rule, he ignored them, and they ignored him. In a paper sack, Joel had two hardbacks, Intruder in the Dust, which was brand new and yet to be read, and his father's well-worn edition of As I Lay Dying. The restaurant was empty at that hour, and Joel and Marianne sat as close to Mr. Faulkner as was reasonable without violating his privacy. Joel was hopeful that Faulkner would notice the stunning co-ed and wish to flirt, something he was prone to do. But he was too absorbed with his reading. He was oblivious to everything around him. They ordered iced tea and vegetable plates and spoke quietly while waiting for an opening. Joel was at once thrilled to be staring into the lovely face of the girl he was dreaming of and to be so close to Faulkner, with the determination to say hello. When Faulkner was half finished with his barbecued chicken, he shoved it aside, took one bite of peach cobbler, then pulled out his pipe. He glanced around, finally, and noticed Marianne. Joel was amused at his double take and obvious interest. Faulkner stared her up and down as he fiddled with his pipe. Joel was on his feet. He stepped over, apologized for the intrusion, and asked the great man if he would be so kind as to autograph his father's copy of As I Lay Dying, a book that Joel loved, and also his own edition of Intruder in the Dust.
"Of course," Mr. Faulkner said politely in a high-pitched voice.
He removed a pen from his coat pocket and took both books. "I'm Joel Banning, a law student here."
"A pleasure to meet you, son. And your friend?"
Faulkner asked, smiling at her. "Marianne Maloof, also a student."
"They look younger every year."
He opened the first book, wrote nothing but his name in small print, closed it, smiled, handed it back, then signed the second one. Joel said, "Thanks, Mr. Faulkner." And when he could think of nothing else, and it was obvious Faulkner was finished with his end of the conversation, Joel backed away and returned to his seat. He had not managed to shake hands, and he was certain Faulkner would never remember his name. Nevertheless, Joel had had his encounter, one that he would talk about for the rest of his life. In November, Birch filed his third petition, and in December, his fourth. After sitting on the case for 6 months, Chancellor Rumbold decided it was time to rule. In a two-page decision, he found that the conveyance by Pete Banning of his land to his two children was proper and in no way fraudulent. He denied any relief to Jackie Bell. Expecting as much, Birch Dunlap perfected his appeal almost overnight, filed his brief, and hurried the case to Jackson, to a Supreme Court that was already quite familiar with the facts. Over the Christmas holidays, Joel stayed with Flory and spent his days at the Wilbanks firm writing the reply brief in opposition to Dunlap's appeal. His research, much of which had already been done, was exhaustive and thorough and troubling. As a general rule, when looking at all jurisdictions, the case law tended to favor the orderly transfer of land among generations of family members. However, the law also took a dim view of those involved in criminal activity transferring assets to avoid the claims of their victims.
There was little doubt Pete tried to get rid of his land before he killed Dexter Bell. As Joel labored for hours over his research and writing, he often felt as though generations of his ancestors were present in the room with him. They had cleared the land, clawed it from the wilderness, tilled the soil with oxen and mules, lost crops to floods and pests, added acreage when they could afford to, borrowed money, endured lean years, and paid off their loans after bumper harvests. They had been born on the land and buried there. And now, after more than a century, it all came down to young Joel and his legal skills. In Old Sycamore, they were resting under neat rows of tombstones. Were there ghosts watching Joel and praying for a win? Such questions were heavy burdens, and Joel went about his day with a thick knot in his stomach. The family was humiliated enough. Losing the land would haunt them forever. He was also burdened by the obvious reality that he and Stella were counting on the income for many years. They would pursue their careers and find success, but they had been raised to believe that the family farm would always provide some level of support. Raised on the soil, they knew there were good years and bad, bumper crops and floods, ups and downs in the market, and that nothing was guaranteed. But their land was free and clear, and thus able to withstand the lean harvests. Losing it would be hard to accept. Then there was Liza. She talked more and more of coming home, of getting back into her life on the farm. She claimed to miss Nineveh, which Joel doubted. But she missed her rituals, her gardening, her horses, her friends. If it all vanished, the damage could be catastrophic. At every visit, Dr. Hilzebeck inquired about the lawsuits and appeals and all that legal mess that to him was indecipherable. So Joel researched and wrote. John Wilbanks reviewed his drafts, edited, and offered comments. He filed his brief on January 18th, and the waiting game began. The Supreme Court could hear the case in 3 months or 12. That afternoon, Joel packed his papers, cleaned his desk, and tidied the little office where he had spent so many hours. He had already said goodbye to Flory and planned to drive to Oxford that night to begin his fourth semester of law school. He joined John Wilbanks on the terrace for a drink. The weather was unseasonably warm and spring-like. John lit a cigar and offered one to Joel, who declined. They sipped Jack Daniel's sour mash and commented on the weather. Wilbanks said, "We hate to see you go, Joel. It's nice having you around the office." "I enjoy it," Joel said, though it was a stretch. "We'd like to have you back this summer for another clerkship." "Thanks, I appreciate that." He had no plans to return for the summer, or next year, or the one after that. But it was too soon to inform John Wilbanks. "I may stay in school this summer," he said. "Finish next December."
"What's the rush? You'd better enjoy the college days, son."
"I'm tired of those days. I want to get out and start a career."
"Well, I hope you'll consider our offer of an associate's position."
Why beat around the bush? His father never minced words and was admired for his bluntness. Joel took a long pull on the whiskey and said, "Mr. Wilbanks, I'm not sure I can practice law in this town. When I see that courthouse, and it's rather hard to miss, I think of my father's last moments. I think of him walking bravely down the street, crowds on both sides, all the veterans here to honor him, to support him. And I can just see him walking into the building and up the stairs to his death. His long walk to the grave. And when I enter that courtroom,
I can think of only one image. My father getting strapped in.
I understand, Joel.
I'm convinced I'll never be able to erase that image. How can I represent clients in that courtroom?
I understand.
Chapter 44. On March 28th, 13 months after the trial in Oxford, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans affirmed the $100,000 wrongful death verdict. The opinion was short and unanimous. While the justices were alarmed at the size of the verdict, they were thoroughly unsympathetic to the interests of a man of means who so brazenly murdered his own pastor. The crime was calculated. The victim's family suffered greatly. The jurors heard the case, listened to the witnesses, reviewed the documents, and deliberated thoughtfully. The justices would not substitute their opinions for those of the jurors, affirmed on all counts. For the Bannings, the decision was devastating. The Wilbanks brothers and Joel had convinced themselves that the verdict would indeed stand on appeal, but would certainly be reduced. $50,000 in punitive damages was unheard of. Given the value of Pete's land and his other assets, it was conceivable that his estate could withstand a lesser award, perhaps something in the neighborhood of $50,000. The eventual owners of the land, whether Joel and Stella or Pete's estate, could borrow that much with a mortgage and satisfy the judgment. But an enforceable lien of $100,000 looked insurmountable. The future of the land now rested solely with the Mississippi Supreme Court. If it upheld Rumbold's ruling that the conveyance was proper, then Joel and Stella would keep the land. Birch Dunlap and his now permanent sidekick, Errol McLeish, would be forced to attack Pete's other assets, bank accounts, farm equipment, livestock, automobiles, in order to squeeze whatever money they could find. But if the court reversed Rumbold, the land reverted to Pete's estate and would become subject to the jury's verdict. Everything, including the home and furnishings, would be lost. With Joel's assistance, John Wilbanks appealed the Fifth Circuit's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, a complete waste of time. However, the appeal would keep Dunlap busy and by a few months. Dunlap enrolled the $100,000 judgment, now with interest clicking away, with the circuit clerk in Ford County. Wilbanks ran to Chancery Court, woke up old Rumbold, and petitioned for an injunction to prevent Dunlap from trying to grab assets pending the appeal. After a brief and contentious hearing, Rumbold once again ruled in favor of the Bannings. Dunlap petitioned the Mississippi Supreme Court for an expedited hearing. Wilbanks opposed it. Joel monitored the assaults and counterattacks from the safety of his garage apartment in Oxford. For $10 a month, he leased the ground floor of the garage and, using his father's Ford truck, began quietly moving furniture and furnishings from their home to the safety of the garage. Nineveh didn't like it, but she had no say in the matter. In mid-May, Joel and Florrie loaded into her 1939 Lincoln and commenced a long road trip to Virginia. They checked into the Hotel Roanoke, where they hosted a cocktail party for Stella and her friends at Holland's. On a glorious spring day, they sat with a crowd of other proud parents and family members and watched Stella accept her degree in English literature. The following day, while the ladies sipped tea in the shade, Joel hauled boxes and bags from her dorm room to the car. When it was stuffed and he was exhausted, Stella said goodbye to college, to a school she loved, and to her friends. Joel had never seen so many tears, not even at a good funeral. With the women in the rear seat barking instructions,
and with the view in every mirror blocked by luggage and boxes, they roared away from Hollins and headed north. 3 hours later, they were lost in Richmond, but stopped anyway at a barbecue place in a lesser part of the city. A local pointed this way and that, and after a quick lunch, they were off again, headed for D.C. Stella's grand plan was still to live in New York, work for a magazine, and write serious fiction on the side. Getting there, though, would take more time than she realized. Jobs in publishing were scarce, but every school needed young teachers. St. Agnes in Alexandria was an Episcopal girls' day and boarding school, and it offered her a contract to teach English to ninth graders and serve as a dorm parent. While she and Florrie enjoyed even more tea with the headmistress, Joel schlepped her bags and boxes into a suffocating dorm room even smaller than the last. The school allowed him to park the car in a safe place. For $10, a janitor agreed to keep air in the tires and crank the engine once a day. They called a cab and crossed the Potomac into D.C. At Union Station, they caught their train to New York. Before Birch Dunlap and his greedy clients could seize their money, they had decided to spend some of what was left of it. Stella's tuitions were now in the past, and she had a job. Joel had only one more year of law school, and he would start working. Florrie's land was safe from the vultures, and she had some money buried. 1949 could be their last summer together, so why not do it in style? At the port in Lower Manhattan, they boarded an ocean liner bound for London, and for 2 weeks had a delightful time resting and reading and trying to forget all the troubles back home. On deck, Joel and Stella noticed for the first time how slow Florrie was getting about. She was carrying too much weight, as usual, but she had always been vigorous and busy. Now, though, she was missing a step and seemed winded after even a short walk. She was only 50, but aging and looking tired. In London, they spent a week at the St. Regis Hotel and saw the sights, then traveled to Edinburgh, where they boarded the Royal Scotsman for a week in the Highlands. When they were tired of visiting castles, manor homes, historic sites, and distilleries, they returned to London for a 2-day rest before pushing on to Paris. Stella and Joel were having coffee in the lobby of the Hotel Lutetia when they got the news. Florrie was not feeling well and had decided to rest through the morning and not walk the city at full throttle. A porter approached and handed Joel a cablegram. It was from John Wilbanks. The Mississippi Supreme Court had voted 7-2 to reverse Rumbold. The conveyance of the land to Joel and Stella was null and void. The property would remain in their father's estate, thus subject to all claims and liens. Reversed and rendered, Joel said in disbelief. What does that mean? Stella asked. It means the case is over. It means the Supreme Court felt strongly that Rumbold was wrong and decided to end the matter without further hearings. What about an appeal? Yes, we'll file another appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court and try to buy some time. Wilbanks and I will discuss bankruptcy. They sipped coffee and watched the foot traffic pass through the luxurious lobby. Stella said, I have a question, and I want an honest answer. Does this mean that Jackie Bell and her children could one day be living in our home? It's possible, but I still don't believe it. At some point, Wilbanks will sit down with her lawyer and push hard to settle everything. And how does that work? We offer them cash. I thought we tried that once. We did, and they turned down $25,000. It'll cost more now. How much? I don't know. It'll be a question of how much money is left in the bank accounts and how much money we can borrow against the land.
Do you really want to mortgage the land, Joel? You know how much Dad hated banks.
We may not have a choice.
In its ruling, the state Supreme Court found that Pete's conduct amounted to fraud in several ways. First, he retained an interest in his land by living on it and farming it and profiting from it. Second, he received nothing in return for the deed to his children. Third, the transfer of ownership was to family members, which is always suspicious. And fourth, at the time he signed the deed, he had reason to believe that he would one day be pursued by creditors because of his actions. John Wilbanks read the opinion a dozen times and found the court's logic sound. He went through the useless routine of appealing the decision to the only court left, the U.S. Supreme Court, but knew there was no chance the case would be accepted for argument. He consulted with a close friend in Memphis who was a bankruptcy specialist and was not encouraged by the conversation. Putting Pete's estate into bankruptcy would be a smart delaying tactic, but a successful outcome would be difficult. Wilbanks went back to Chancery Court for another injunction to prevent a foreclosure pending appeals, and of course, Rumbold gave it to him. Dunlap took another lump and appealed. Soon enough, though, not even a highly biased judge like Rumbold could forestall the inevitable. After the hearing, a composed and quite confident Dunlap chatted with Wilbanks and offered a proposal. It was time to stop running up legal bills and face the obvious. The appeals would not work, nor would a bankruptcy. Why not simply deed the land, all 640 acres, plus the house and furnishings, over to Jackie Bell? If the Bannings would agree to it, then Jackie would forego all claims to the bank accounts. Wilbanks bristled at the proposal and said, as he walked away, "The Bannings will burn the house and the crops before they sign over a deed." Dunlap shot back, "Great, but please remind your clients that arson is still a crime, punishable by a long prison sentence." When Joel and Florrie crossed the state line into Mississippi in late July, they began to notice, as always, the cotton, and it was not encouraging. Heavy rains in the spring had delayed the planting, and in the 2 months they had been living it up in England and Europe, the weather had obviously not cooperated. In a good year, the cotton bloomed by July 4th, and by Labor Day it was chest high. This was the worst-looking crop in recent memory, and as they crossed through the farmlands of North Mississippi, the cotton looked worse. There were no blooms. The stalks were hardly knee-high. In low spots, entire acres had been washed out. Nineveh made a pot of coffee and asked about their trip. They asked about the weather and got an earful. While they were gone, it rained every day, it seemed, and even when it wasn't raining, the skies were cloudy. Cotton needed days and days of dry weather and hot sun, and, well, it was obvious the weather was killing the crops. Amos was fighting it in the garden, but the yield was far below normal. As if life on the Banning farm wasn't depressing enough. Joel drove his aunt to the Pink cottage and unloaded her luggage. They had a drink on the porch, stared at the pathetic crops, and wished they were back in Scotland. John Wilbanks wanted to see him, and as badly as Joel wanted to avoid the law office and the courthouse and everything else about downtown Clanton, he had no choice. They met in the large conference room on the ground floor, a sign that the meeting was of extra importance. Russell also joined them, another sure signal. The brothers promptly fired up their smokes, the standard short black cigar for John and a cigarette for Russell. Joel declined and said he would join them just by breathing the air.
John recapped the litigation. They had two frivolous appeals filed with the U.S. Supreme Court, and they could expect both to be rejected within a couple of months, as soon as a clerk there got around to the paperwork. There was no reason whatsoever for the court to show any interest in either case. Birch Dunlap had enrolled the $100,000 judgment across the street and would wait patiently for the Bannings and their lawyers to tire themselves with useless legal maneuverings and throw in the towel. "What about bankruptcy?" Joel asked. "It won't work, because the estate is not bankrupt. We could do it and stall, but Dunlap would waste no time getting a hearing before the bankruptcy judge. And remember, if we put the estate into bankruptcy, the trustee then assumes control of the estate. We don't name the trustee. The court does." Russell let loose a cloud of smoke and said, "There's an excellent chance the trustee could order the executrix, Florrie, to hand over all assets to the judgment creditor, Jackie Bell." "None of this is surprising," Joel said. "And there's something else," Russell said. "We need to get paid. Our bill is now over $7,000, and I'm not sure there's enough in the estate to pay us. We've been shotgunning petitions and motions right and left, hoping for a miracle, and it's taken a lot of time. Using a bankruptcy as a stall tactic just eats more clock."
"I understand."
John said, "We're at the end of the road, Joel. There's nothing left except a good faith effort to settle with these people. We have one idea left, and it's the only one that might save the land. It requires a mortgage on both pieces of property, Pete's and Florrie's, all 1,200 acres. You borrow as much as you can and offer it to Dunlap to settle everything." Cautiously, Joel asked, "How much?" "The house is valued at $30,000. The land is worth about $100 an acre on the high side, but you'd have a hard time getting that much in this market. As you know, only about 1,000 acres are planted. No bank is going to lend the full value because of the risk. Think about it. Pete managed to either break even or show a profit most years because he owned the land free and clear. Plus, he worked himself to the bone, pushed his workers, and watched every dime. Burden the land with a mortgage, and suddenly you're in business with a bank. A couple of bad crops like this one, and you fall behind. Before you know it, the bank starts talking about foreclosure. Happens every year around here, even in good years." Russell took the handoff and said, "We've talked to our brother over at the bank, and he's not too keen on the deal. If Pete were alive and cracking the whip, the farm would be more attractive. But he's gone. You're not a farmer. Florrie's crazy as hell. I can see the banks running from this one." Joel asked, "How much would your brother lend?"
$75,000 at the most," John said.
Russell added, "And I'm not sure about that. There's another problem that's rather obvious. We represent your family, and we represent the bank. What if there's a default? The law firm suddenly has a huge conflict of interest, one that could land us in serious trouble."
John said, "And we haven't discussed this with the other bank in town. As you know, there's a good bit of rivalry involved between the families. I doubt they would touch it, but we could possibly take it to a larger bank in Tupelo."
Joel stood and walked around the room. "I can't ask Florrie to mortgage her land. That's simply too much. It's all she's got, and if she lost it, I don't know where she'd go. I can't do it. I'm not going to ask her."
John flicked ashes into a dish and said, "Here's a plan. Tell me what you think. I'll sit down with Dunlap and negotiate. He probably took this case on a contingency and hasn't been paid a dime yet. So he might have an interest in a cash settlement. I'll start at $50,000 and we'll see what he's thinking. You can handle $50,000, right?"
"I suppose," Joel said, "but the thought of owing that much makes me sick."
It should. But you and Stella can keep your land and your home.
What if they want too much?
We'll see. Let's have the first round of negotiations. I'll act as poor as possible.
Chapter 45. In the stifling heat of August, Liza's little room was unbearable. There was no window to catch a breeze, nothing to break the suffocating humidity but a flimsy box fan Joel had brought her the summer before. After a few minutes, they were both sweating and decided to go hunt for shade. She was walking well these days. Her condition had improved, at least physically. She had gained a few pounds, though still ate little. At times, the Thorazine gave her an appetite. It certainly calmed her, and she didn't fidget nonstop and pull at her hair as before. She cut her hair short and washed it more often, and she had ditched the pale and permanently stained hospital gowns for the simple cotton dresses Stella sent. A milestone had been reached a month earlier when Stella brought in 3 tubes of lipstick, and Liza was thrilled. Now each visitor was greeted with a bright red smile. Dr. Hilzebeck continued to say that he was pleased with her progress, but Joel had lost hope that his mother would ever recover enough to leave. After 3 years in the institution, it had become her home. Yes, she had improved, but then she had had so far to climb. They left the building and walked to the pond, where they sat on a picnic table under the shade of an oak. The heat was brutal, and the air was too thick to stir, so it hung in one place with no hint of a breeze. Unlike most visits, Joel looked forward to this one because he had so much to talk about. In vivid detail, he recounted their travels to New York, London, Scotland, and Paris. Liza listened with a pretty smile, one that broke his heart, because it was the best she could ever hope for. His mother was not coming home, and home was a subject he could not discuss. He found a dirty room in a cheap tourist motel near the beach in Biloxi, and went looking for Marianne Maloof, who was no longer engaged to the guy in Washington. In the past year, she had seen a lot of Joel, primarily because he simply would not go away. At Ole Miss, they had sneaked around for late dinners. They had taken 2 road trips to Memphis, where they would not be seen. He had pressed her to ditch the guy in D.C. and hook up with a real man. During the summer, she was working a few hours a week in a dress store on Main Street, and when he walked through the door, she was pleasantly surprised. He hung around long enough to get harsh looks from her boss, then left. They met for a soda after hours and discussed meeting her family. He insisted on it. She was hesitant. Her parents approved of her fiancé and would not understand a new suitor hanging around. Feeling a bit stiff-armed, Joel bummed around the coast for a few days, trying to avoid both the return home and anything resembling meaningful employment. He knocked on the doors of several law firms, landed 2 quick interviews, but no job offer. The longer he stayed, the more he liked Biloxi, with its ethnic blend, cafes offering all manner of fresh seafood, lounges that somehow served alcohol without getting busted, boats rocking in the harbors, and the laid-back atmosphere usually found along the ocean. And the longer he chased Marianne Maloof, the more determined he was to catch her. Birch Dunlap spent the month of August in Montana away from the heat. Evidently, the vacation served him well. He returned to the office after Labor Day, filled with energy and determined to make more money. His nearest target was the Banning case. In Chancery Court, still and always the unquestioned domain of Chancellor Abbott Rumbold, he filed a lawsuit seeking a judicial foreclosure of the Banning land. He had no choice but to file in Ford County. The law was clear.
Indeed, the law was so clear, Birch was curious to see how the old judge could manipulate it to favor the Bannings. A week later, he sat down in his conference room to welcome his friend, John Wilbanks, who was coming to Tupelo to open settlement negotiations. Or, as Dunlap had confided to his ever-present confidant, Errol MacLeish, to beg for mercy. And there would be none. John was served coffee and offered a seat on one side of the handsome table. Across from him sat Dunlap, and to his right was MacLeish, a man John had quickly learned to despise. Dunlap lit a cigar and, after some small talk, said, "You have the money, John. Why don't you tell us what you have in mind?" "Of course. Obviously, my clients would like to keep the family land. They are also tired of paying me." "You've done a lot of work that wasn't necessary," Dunlap said, almost rudely. "We've been worried about your fees, frankly. That money comes out of the estate." "Look, Birch, why don't you worry about your fees and I'll worry about mine. Fair enough?" Reprimanded, Birch laughed loudly, as if his pal had really nailed a great punchline. "Fair enough. Go on." "There's not a lot of cash in the estate, so whatever we offer you to settle has to come from money that will be borrowed against the house and land." "How much, John?" "It's a question of how much income the farm can produce each year in order to service the mortgage. This year is a disaster. As you know, it's a risky business. My family has been farming cotton for decades, and I often wonder if it's really worth it." "Your family's done well, John." "In some endeavors, yes. The Bannings think they can borrow $50,000 against their property and survive the mortgage. That's the best they can do." Dunlap offered a sappy smile as if he had really enjoyed round one and said, "Come on, John. They own 1,200 acres free and clear, and 1,000 of it is rich farmland. Their home is one of the finest in the county. They have half a dozen outbuildings, fine structures all, plus the farm equipment and livestock. And how many Negroes?" "Please, Birch, they don't own those people. For all practical purposes, they do. 50 is really lowball, John. I thought we agreed to meet for a serious discussion." "Well, you can't be serious if you include the land owned by Flory Banning. That's half of it, and she's not involved in the litigation. She's completely unaffected by all of this." "Not so fast, John. Pete Banning farmed his sister's property, just like he farmed his, and gave her half the profits. Both sections came from the same source, their parents and their grandparents, and so on." "This is absurd, Birch. Flory had nothing to do with the killing of Dexter Bell, and you know it. To imply that her land is in play is ridiculous. If you think otherwise, then try and foreclose on it." "We can't foreclose on anything as long as you keep old Rumbold in your hip pocket." John smiled and said, "He's a brilliant jurist, one of the best." "Maybe, but down in Jackson, the Supremes are not so impressed. $50,000 ain't flying, John." "I've put a figure on the table. Now it's your turn." MacLeish said coldly, "At least $100,000. Frankly, Jackie deserves more, because we need to pay Mr. Dunlap." Mr. Dunlap said, "$120,000, John. I have this case on a contingency, and I've won it fair and square. I've done a heck of a job for my client, and I don't want my fees to come out of her settlement. You've done a superb job, Birch, no question about it. But your numbers are far above anything we can afford. No bank will lend more than $75,000 for Pete's land and the house. Flory's land is off limits." "Are you offering $75,000? Dunlap asked. "Not yet. But would you take $75,000 if it were on the table?" MacLeish shook his head and said, "No." Both lawyers were good negotiators, and it was obvious who held the upper hand. When swimming against the tide, John knew it was often beneficial to muddy the waters. He said, "Look, Birch, the kids would really like to save the house, the only home they've ever known. You know about their mother and her troubles. There's the chance that Liza may come home one day, and it's crucial that she has her place. Can we discuss separating it and the buildings from the farmland? I'm working on a plat that would carve out only 4 acres that includes the house, the gardens, and barns, and such, and your client would take the rest."
"The deed for the farm minus the 4 acres? Dunlap asked.
"Something like that. I'm just exploring alternatives here."
"How much are they willing to pay for the 4 acres?
"The house is appraised at $30,000, which is definitely on the high side. These are two fine kids who are trying to hang on to something."
"How are they going to service a mortgage on the home?"
"Good question. We'll figure it out. Flory might help them."
The biggest obstacle to this proposal was one that would not be mentioned. Jackie Bell wanted the house. In fact, she wanted the house far more than she wanted the land. Her boyfriend fancied himself a gentleman farmer and was already counting his money. But Jackie just wanted a beautiful home. McLeish shook his head and said, "No way. Those 4 acres are worth almost as much as the farmland. We can't do it." He spoke with the air of a man who was entitled to his rewards, in this case, the treasured soil of some of the finest people John Wilbanks had ever known. He despised McLeish for his arrogance and his sense of entitlement. John said,
"Well, it looks as though we have nothing left to discuss."
In late September, on back-to-back days, the U.S. Supreme Court laid waste to a batch of frivolous requests for hearings. On one day, it hammered home the final nail in the coffin in the Banning appeal of the verdict in federal court, and on the very next day, it brushed aside the Banning appeal from the Mississippi reversal of Rumbold's ruling. The path was now clear for a hearing on the petition by Dunlap for a judicial foreclosure. Rather, the path should have been unobstructed. Standing in the way was His Honor himself, and old Rumbold was getting creakier by the month. Dunlap bellowed and screamed and demanded a timely day in court. Rumbold, almost deaf, heard nothing. And then he died. On October 9, 1949, Abbot Rumbold succumbed to old age and passed at 81. He died peacefully in his sleep, or as the colored folks preferred to say, he woke up dead. With 37 years of service, he was the ranking chancellor in the state. Joel drove from Ole Miss and attended his funeral at First Baptist with John and Russell Wilbanks. The service was a tribute to a man who lived a long, happy, and productive life. There were few tears, a lot of humor, and the warm feeling that one of God's saints had simply gone home. Joel's next burial would be far different.
Chapter 46. To escape the monotony and to ease some of the healthier patients into normalcy, the doctors and administrators at Whitfield arranged weekly visits to the Paramount Theater on East Capitol Street in downtown Jackson. For each matinee, an unmarked bus stopped on a side street a block from the theater, and 20 or so patients got off. They were accompanied by orderlies and nurses, and once off the bus, they worked hard to appear as if they had simply arrived like everyone else. They wore street clothes and blended in with the crowd. An untrained eye would never suspect that they were being treated for all manner of serious mental illnesses. Liza loved the movies and volunteered at every opportunity. She worked on her hair, put on makeup, layered on the lipstick, and wore one of the dresses Stella had sent. The Paramount was showing Adam's Rib, a comedy with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and the lobby was busy by 1 p.m. The head nurse bought their tickets and guided them to two rows of seats. On Liza's left was an older lady named Beverly, an acquaintance who'd been institutionalized for years, and to her right was Karen, a sad young woman who usually slept during the shows. 15 minutes into the movie, Liza whispered to Beverly that she needed to visit the ladies' room. She eased to the aisle, whispered the same thing to a nurse, and left the auditorium. Then she left the theater. She walked 2 blocks along East Capitol to Mill Street and entered the Illinois Central Station, where she purchased a second-class ticket for the 150 train to Memphis. Her hand was shaking as she took the ticket, and she needed to sit down. The station was practically empty, and she found an empty seat far away from anyone else. She breathed deeply, composed herself, and from a small pocket pulled out a folded sheet of paper. It was a list of what to do next, one she had been putting together for weeks. She feared she would easily become overwhelmed and need guidance. She read it, refolded it, and returned it to her pocket. She left the station, walked 1 block along Mill Street to a department store, and purchased a cheap handbag, an even cheaper straw hat, and a magazine. She stuffed her remaining cash, a small bottle of pills, and 1 tube of lipstick into the purse, and hurried back to the station. As she waited there, she reviewed her list again, smiled at herself for the success so far, and watched the entrance in case anyone from the hospital appeared. They did not. The nurse enjoyed the comedy so much she forgot about Liza and her trip to the ladies' room. When she finally remembered, she immediately left to go look. Finding nothing, she corralled 2 orderlies, and they began searching the theater, which was almost full. In the lobby, no one remembered seeing a slim lady in a yellow dress leave after the movie started. They continued searching, but soon ran out of places to look. The 2 orderlies began roaming the streets of downtown Jackson, and one finally strolled through the train station. By then, Liza was an hour north of town, sitting alone by a window, clutching her list, staring blankly at the passing countryside, and struggling with the rush of sights and sounds from the real world. She had been locked up for 3.5 years. The police were called, and Dr. Hilzebeck was notified. Everyone was alarmed, but not panicked. Liza was not deemed a threat to anyone else, and she was stable enough to take care of herself for a few hours anyway. Dr. Hilzebeck did not want to alarm the family, nor did he want his staff to appear incompetent, so he delayed calling either Joel, Flory, or Sheriff Nix Gridley. Liza purchased her ticket with cash, and there was no record of who the passengers were. However, a ticket clerk remembered a lady who fit Liza's description and said she was headed north to Memphis. This was around 3 p.m. The movie was over, and the bus had to return to Whitfield. When the train arrived in Batesville, its 6th stop, at 4:15, Liza decided to get off. She assumed someone was looking for her, and she suspected they might be watching the trains and buses. Outside the station were 2 taxis, both old pre-war sedans that appeared even more unreliable than the 2 drivers who were leaning on a bumper. She asked the first one if he would take her to Clanton, 1.5 hours away. She offered $10, but he was worried about his tires. The second one said he would do it for $15. His tires looked even worse, but she didn't have many options. As she got into the rear seat, her driver said,
No luggage?
No. I'm traveling light. He got behind the wheel, and they drove away from the station. He glanced into the mirror and said,
Mighty pretty dress you got on.
Liza lifted her purse and said, I carry a Colt pistol whenever I travel, and I know how to use it. Anything funny, and you'll be sorry.
Sorry, ma'am.
Outside town, he found the nerve to speak again.
Anything on the radio, ma'am?
Sure, whatever you like. He turned on the radio, fiddled with the dial, and found a country station out of Memphis. It was after dark when Hilzebeck finally made contact with Joel. He explained what had happened and admitted they were searching in vain. Joel was stunned to think that his mother was loose and doing something that she had obviously planned. He was petrified by fear and uncertain where to go. Should he drive to Jackson and help with the search? Or Memphis, where she was believed to be going? Or Clanton? Or just sit and wait? He called Stella and assured her things would be fine. He needed to call Flory, but decided to wait. Her phone was still on a rural party line with a dozen others, and the eavesdroppers would go berserk with the news that Liza Banning had escaped from Whitfield. For an hour, Joel paced around his apartment, uncertain, waiting for the call that his mother had been found and was fine. He called the sheriff's department in Clanton, but no one answered. He figured old Tick Poley was in a deep sleep. A total jailbreak could be underway, and Tick wouldn't know it. He finally reached Nick's Gridley at home, on his private line, and told him about Liza's latest. Nick's offered his sympathies and said he would drive out and tell Flory. When the taxi left the highway and pulled onto the long drive to the Banning estate, Liza told the driver to stop. She paid him $15, thanked him, and got out. When he disappeared down the dark and deserted road, she began walking slowly in the pitch blackness, barely able to see the gravel drive in front of her. There was not a single light on in the house, the barns, any of the outbuildings. In the distance, a dim glow emanated from a window in the small house where Nineveh and Amos had lived forever. As she felt her way along the gravel, the outline of the house settled into view. She crossed the front lawn, then the porch, and rattled the doorknob. It was locked, which was unusual in the country. No one locked their door. She wanted to inspect the flower beds and shrubs to see how much had changed in 3.5 years, but there was no light, no moon on a cloudy night. She walked to the side and saw Pete's truck parked exactly where he had left it. She knew that Joel had assumed ownership of the Pontiac. In the backyard, she inched her way through the dead grass. A breeze kicked in from the west, and she shivered and rubbed her arms. The rear door to the kitchen was unlocked. She entered her home and stood in the kitchen, stopped cold by an aroma that was so thick and familiar, it overwhelmed her. A mix of cigarette smoke and coffee, bacon grease, fruity pies and cakes, thick beef and venison stews that Nineveh simmered on the stove for days, steam from the canning of stewed tomatoes and a dozen vegetables. Wet leather from Pete's boots in a corner. The sweet, soapy smell of Nineveh herself. Liza was staggered by the dense fragrances and leaned on a counter. In the darkness, she could hear the voices of her children as they giggled over breakfast and got themselves shooed away from the stove by Nineveh. She could hear Pete sitting there at the kitchen table with his coffee and cigarettes, reading the Tupelo Daily. A cloud moved somewhere, and a ray of moonlight entered through a window. She focused, and her kitchen came into view. she breathed as slowly as possible, sucking in the sweet smells of her former life. Liza wiped some